The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, Casual Friday, February 21st, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, ladies and gentlemen, a progressive challenger to Chris Coons, the state of Delaware, Jessica Scarane, will be on the show. An interview I did with her on Ring of Fire a couple weeks ago. Chris Coons is the worst. He was already planning to sell us out in the event that we get a Democratic president, already setting up his gang of three or five, or you know, it'll be like four or six or eight, whatever it is, where he combines with, like, I don't know, Chuck Grassley, the problem-solving caucus, which basically means we're going to stop any progress. That would be a major upgrade. Then, after Jess Garain, Professor Joe William Trotter, on his book, Workers on Arrival, Black Labor in the Making of America. Interesting take on what we need to know, particularly at a time where so much of, when we talk of the working class, is focused on the white working class. When in fact that tells barely any of the story. And particularly in an era when we have such polarization and largely people are coming around to understand that this is not an election of persuasion, but rather of bringing people out to vote who are low propensity voters, basically because they don't have any faith that material benefit is going to be delivered to them, however they define that material benefit. Having an understanding of the history of black labor in this country, hugely important. So, quick break. Bring you first the interview with Jess Garain, then the one with Joe William Trotter.
So, Jessica, I mean, for folks that don't have a sense about the state of Delaware, give us a sense of it. I mean, I know you live in Wilmington, and that is distinct in many respects from Delaware as well. But give us a sense about who you have to appeal to in this state if you are going to defeat Chris Coons in this primary.
Sure. So I'm sure people know it's a pretty small state. We have fewer than a million people here. But in a lot of ways, it's a state that's in some ways a microcosm of the country. We have dense city populations. We have rural and farms. We have suburbs and we have the beaches. So we have a really diverse state as far as the types of communities that we have here. But it's also a state where we have really drastic wealth inequality. We have really poor, under-resourced neighborhoods that are just 2 miles away from historically very wealthy neighborhoods that have been around since the DuPonts first kind of put their stake here in Delaware. So what we're looking at is, who are the people who have been Bernie voters in 2016, Kerry Evelyn Harris voters in 2018, who have become the base of the progressive push here in our state? And who are the people who are feeling really disenfranchised or disengaged based on the choices that they've been presented for years now? There really has been limited choice in Delaware. It's not a state that has a lot of primaries to incumbents. It's very uncommon, and it takes a lot of courage for someone like Kerry Evelyn Harris last year to do that, and for the many candidates that are doing that this year. So we want to look at those voters, too, those people who haven't felt like voting makes a difference because their life doesn't materially change no matter who's in that seat. So that's where we are focusing our strategy, is getting out voters who are younger, who are less engaged, and who are already bought into this progressive agenda that we're putting forward.
So when we're talking about a state this size, I mean, you know, they're... I'm in a city with more people probably within a 5-10 mile radius. What is its history in terms of electing Republicans? In other words, I know it's a D6 state, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. which is basically the Democrats have a 6-point advantage on day one, if you will, relative mm-hmm. to any generic Republican. But I mean, how great? I mean, what are the implications of winning the primary, I guess, is what I want to say, in terms of the general election for the Senate there?
I think the prospects are good. I don't think that we would be jeopardizing a Democratic seat. As you mentioned, it is a blue state here. Our voter registration skews Democratic drastically. The state has had largely Democratic representation for decades now. So I don't think that there's we're not necessarily presenting a concern about disrupting the ability to have a Democrat in representing us in the Senate.
Okay. And I ask that because, you know, obviously that's a big question that people have in terms of primaries. How much are we jeopardizing this seat? Obviously, every seat in the Senate is really important. Now, with that said, I would be less than forthcoming if I didn't say that I was very much hoping that somebody would primary Chris Coons for a myriad of reasons. And I want to get, obviously, to the list of issues that you support. In a bit, because I think there, you know, obviously people should have positive reasons to vote. But when we're talking about voting for a challenger mm-hmm. against incumbent, I think there has to be a case as to why the incumbent is not necessarily serving their constituency well. And now I have about a half dozen reasons of my own about Chris Coons, and we've been mostly talking to challengers of Congress people, and I generally don't have this many reasons. But mm-hmm. let's hear yours. I mean, specifically in terms of Chris Coons, where is Chris Coons failing the people of Delaware?
Yeah, so at the core point here, there are quite a few contrasts that I'm drawing, right? I am looking to run a campaign that is people-centric. I want a government that puts our people at its core and legislates for the people. And we have a senator right now who is not focused on that. He has taken hundreds of thousands of dollars from industries like Big Pharma and then directly starts working on bills that are going to benefit those industries. So he's working on a bill right now to do quote-unquote patent reform. But what that is doing is actually putting stronger patents in the hands of pharmaceutical companies, preventing generic competition, and creating higher prices for Delawareans. So when I look at things like that, I see a senator who's not fighting for the people of Delaware. I look at things like lack of commitment to economic justice, things like saying minimum wage, raising it to $15, that it wouldn't necessarily be, it would be too much money for places in even our state. And we know that that's not true. We know that to have a median run-of-the-mill sort of average one-bedroom apartment, you need to be making at least $18 in our state to be able to afford that without overtaxing yourself. So he's not even clued into the experience that voters have in our state. And on top of that, he really seems to have bipartisanship in his mind as the end game. And I don't inherently have a problem with bipartisanship or compromise, but when I see that done at the expense of Delawareans, that's when I start to recognize that there has to be something beyond bipartisanship that we are fighting for. It can't be simply about making that compromise. The example of this is last year when he worked with Jeff Flake during the Kavanaugh hearings to fight for this FBI investigation. And then he and Jeff Flake went on this tour on television talking about this compromise while the FBI completely failed to conduct a thorough investigation of the claims that were against Brett Kavanaugh. And those are the things that Chris Coons has been doing, like rubber stamping a lot of Trump judges. He's voted for more than 80 of them, many of which who are anti-choice and anti-women's rights and civil rights and have not confirmed their support for things like Brown versus Board of Education. He has confirmed many of Trump's appointees, including people like Kirstjen Nielsen, who is no longer in the job after she was defending the camps that exist at our borders right now. People like Alex Azar, who is a drug company lobbyist and former drug company executive who is now running Health and Human Services. And he wants to position himself as a centrist that can make deals, but in reality, it ends up just pulling him to the right side and not fighting for the people of Delaware.
You know, I know that Politico magazine called him the, quote, the GOP's favorite Democrat. And I'm glad you brought up that notion of a supposed bipartisanship. Very often in my experience, and I've been watching this stuff for 15 years, that is often a fig leaf to promote, mm-hmm. like you say, a corporate agenda. When Chris Coons is already talking about after Mitch McConnell has basically just turned the Senate into a factory to confirm right-wing judges. They have confirmed more judges almost in 3 years under Trump than they did under 8 years under Obama on the circuit court. Mm-hmm. When Chris Coons says he wants to bring back the filibuster if the Democrats take control, that to me is a sign that this guy does not want Democrats to be able to influence our government in the way that Republicans have. And I understand if you come from Montana or something and this is your disposition, but this is a state that is, like we said earlier, a Democratic leaning state by over 6 points.
All right, we'll be back with the second half of that Jess Scrain interview in a moment. But I should tell you, and I've talked about this in the past, I don't like to share too much of my details of my hygiene regimen. But I have avoided conventional deodorants for as long as I can because many of them contain things like aluminum, which not only plugs your sweat glands, keep you from sweating, but I just, you know, any type of stuff like that, I get a little bit nervous about. Native's deodorant, it's made without aluminum, so you can feel better about what you're putting on your body while smelling and feeling fresh all day. Native deodorant is formulated without aluminum, without parabens, without talc. It's made with ingredients you've actually heard of, like coconut oil or shea butter. Comes in over 10 scents, like coconut and vanilla and lavender and rose. Now, of course, I don't go anywhere near the lavender. For me, my Native deodorant, I got the unscented. I love it. Native is also excited for the relaunch of their toothpaste. Native's toothpaste uses a special blend of naturally derived cleaners, flavors, and whiteners to deliver a great brushing experience and the same clean mouth feeling that you're used to. They offer two minty flavors with the option of fluoride or fluoride-free that will help keep your mouth squeaky clean. There's no risk to try because Native offers free shipping on every order and a 30-day free returns and exchanges in the USA. I've found the Native deodorant to be effective, and like I say, I feel good about the fact that I'm not putting this stuff, you know, aluminum on my body. You can check it out. Like I say, they have a money-back guarantee. And you can now get 20% off your first purchase by going to nativedeodorant.com using the promo code MAJORITY during checkout. That's Native Deodorant, nativedeodorant.com. Coupon code MAJORITY for 20% off your first purchase. Check it out, folks. All right, quick break. Back with our interview with Jess Scrain. And then later, we will follow that up with Joe Trotter. Right back after this.
We talked about what the nature of Delaware and, frankly, the shortcomings of Chris Coons, who is a U.S. senator. And this is why I think, you know, to a large extent, it is important for a national audience to hear from you because Chris Coons obviously is a senator, but he's one of those people who's talking about let's bring back the filibuster if the Democrats attain power. In other words, let's give the Republicans the right to inhibit our ability to in some way mitigate the damage that has been done by the Republicans to our judiciary over the past 10 years because of their obstruction under Obama. This is also a guy, and I do want to get to your issue set because it's a great one as far as I'm concerned. This is always a guy who is also on record as saying that he thinks some of the partisan rancor is a function of, frankly, having a diverse set of senators. I don't know if you caught that. I imagine you have. How important it is to you obviously you're running as a person who supports things like universal health care and housing as a right and combating climate change and economic justice. But I mean, tell me your thoughts about the question of diversity. Do you think that's the problem as to why there's such polarization in our politics?
I think that it is not necessarily diversity that is causing polarization. I think it is a top versus bottom struggle. And people on the bottom are recognizing that they don't feel supported by their government, and that's what they want to see. I think that when you look at the current Senate, you certainly don't see it representing the people of America. And that is something that I think needs to change, because that is why it's not representing the right type of legislation or working in a way to help the people of America. Delaware is a state that has actually never had a female senator. It's never had an African-American senator or Hispanic senator. We have only had men in that seat for the both of those seats for the history of our state. So that doesn't look like our state. So that I do think is something that, while important, it is not the only thing that I am obviously running on, but I think it's important to call out that, yeah, we've tried these same types of people with the same types of experience, and this is where we've gotten. So if we want different results, we need different people. We need different types of experience.
So let's talk about the issues you support. What sits atop your agenda as a senator from Delaware?
Well, I want to talk one bit about Chris Coons on that before I get there, because I am putting forth a pretty progressive platform, and I will talk about it. And he is someone who has called these plans, literally used the words wild-eyed and referred to them as irrational. He is actively working against progressive initiatives right now in the Senate, I assume because he's expecting to see a President Sanders or a President Warren. And he is working with the Budget Committee to pass budget austerity rules that would automatically trigger austerity based on government spending. And that is something that is going to inhibit our ability to put forth the progressive agenda that we want to see. So this is someone who's teaming up with Republicans, again, celebrating their bipartisanship and celebrating coming to an agreement, but at the cost to who? At the cost to people like us who need better services and better programs from our government. And some of those better services and programs that I want to see are, there's five core pieces that I'm running on. One, universal health care. That's Medicare for all, completely comprehensive, no premiums, no deductibles, no copays. You go to the doctor for medical, dental, vision, mental health care, and you leave free at the point of service. We need to lower the price of prescription drugs. We need to be able to negotiate with the drug companies. We need to find ways to break the monopolies that these drug companies have to lower prices and provide patients with more options. I want the federal government to be focused on equitable education. I think our federal government's lack of priority of education and funding behind education has put our states in a position where they are hamstrung and they're unable to create equal systems, because the only tool that they really have at their disposal are property taxes, which are inherently unequal. So the government needs to be committed to free public education from childcare and pre-K all the way through higher education, trade school, two-year college, four-year college, whatever that might be for that student. We know that a high school education is not setting people up for success anymore. We need to make sure that we are progressing our education system with where our workforce is going as well. We need to cancel student debt, which is completely hamstrung an entire generation. And we need to make sure that our schools have funding for the wraparound services that actually make them core strengths, strong points in a neighborhood. So that's things like free meals so that hunger isn't a barrier to education, classroom supplies, nurses, counselors, social workers. These are things that we know schools are lacking, but they make a difference in a child's education. I also believe housing is a right. As I mentioned earlier, it's expensive to live in Delaware. It's not New York or San Francisco, it's Seattle. It's not hitting the headlines, but it's expensive to live here. And all we are seeing right now is development in that luxury tier that only very wealthy people can afford. So we need a federal investment in housing programs so that we can eradicate homelessness in this country. We are the richest country in the world. No one should be going without a safe and affordable home. It is integral to living in this country and surviving in this country. combating climate change, I would sign on to the Green New Deal, transform our energy system, and the extraction of fossil fuels. I'm sorry, finally, just economic justice. I recognize that this is a top versus bottom fight here. We need to make sure that our government is representing working people and fighting to make sure that no one is struggling in our country. No one here should be too poor to live.
So, Jessica, walk us through, just a little bit about you. We have about 2 minutes left here, but just tell us a little bit about yourself. What qualifies you? I mean, aside from having a platform that I think a lot of people support and your opponent not supporting if much of it, what qualifies you to run? And what do you need to do to beat a guy like Chris Coons in the primary?
Yeah. So my drive here is seeing in my work as a board president of a nonprofit here is that I had to go up against our government to ensure that our state government didn't cut nonprofit funding when it had a budget gap. And that was really eye-opening to me that even when we have these services, which we only have because the government fails to provide them, but even when we have them, we know they're not guaranteed. And that is what has exposed me to a different type of experience than we have seen in senators. And I think the qualification should be, do you understand how people live? Do you understand the problems that people are facing in our country? And can you put forth ideas and programs that are going to make it better for people and change their outlook and standard of living in life? As far as what I think it's going to take for us to win, there was a poll released just today by Data for Progress that shows Coons is trailing a generic, more liberal candidate. And when people get exposed to his record, that gap grows even further. So that's our strategy. It is get out on as many doors. We are planning to knock more doors than has ever been knocked in the state. Just last week, we had 20 people out in December in 40-degree weather, which is a lot of people for Delaware, especially this early. And we are going to make sure that we are on the doors, hearing from people, bringing their ideas into our policies, and bringing that vision forward. So not only are we saying, here's what's actually happening with your representative in Washington right now, and here's how we believe it can be different.
When is the primary?
It is September 15th, 2020.
September 15th, 2020. So you got about 10 months to get volunteers, mm-hmm. Donations. Folks can head to your website. Why don't you give it to us now?
Sure. It's justfordelaware.com. If they head to justfordelaware.com/donate, they can make donations. Obviously, that's really important for us coming up on the filing deadline. We are only 3 weeks into this campaign, so we haven't had a lot of this quarter. So we are really looking to push towards the end of the year to show people that there's support and power behind this campaign.
Jessica Scarain, I wish you all the luck in the world, and I'm so glad that Chris Coons is getting a primary race this year. And again, good luck. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the Giant Eagle Professor of History and Social Justice, past History Department Chair and Director of the Center for African American Urban Studies of the Economy at Carnegie Mellon University, Professor Joe William Trotter. Welcome to the program. And I should also say, author of Workers on Arrival, Black Labor in the Making of America. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So I want to start with just a sort of a maybe a 15,000-foot question before we sort of dig into this history and the various implications as we go through the four centuries of black labor in this country. But since, you know, it has become such an important topic in the context of this 2020 election, give me your perspective on how, I guess what we could say is a somewhat blinkered view, or maybe just an overrepresentation of the notion of the white working class. How does that implicate, I guess, our view of the black working class? I mean, where does your work bring us in terms of that dynamic?
Okay, very good question, and I'm glad you asked it. In fact, that is one of the motivating forces of this book, motivating factors. The presidential election of 2016 played a major role in my thinking about how to portray and write about the African-American working class over a period of four centuries. And what really caught my attention is that once Republican Donald J. Trump defeated Hillary Clinton and became the next president of the United States, who was elected, you know, on the conservative wing of the Republican Party. And so in many ways, the most conservative part of the Republican Party. And so after that election, there was just a tremendous outpouring of commentary, debates, and discussions about the role of the working class in American politics. And one of the major things that that debate emphasized pretty much was the white working class. And it raised questions, these debates raised questions about what many of the commentators considered a rightward turn on the part of white workers in the political arena of American 21st century politics. But what happened is that so much of this discussion unfolded within the context of the white working class and largely ignored the role of African-American workers and other workers of color in the history of the working class. And so what my book does, Working on Arrival, tries to do is to bring a perspective to this issue. Because if you look at the history of African-American workers, which I document in this book, it shows that if conservatism has in a way characterized recent white working class history, there is definitely an alternative perspective to be obtained from a closer look at the way African-Americans have engaged the economy and politics of American society. And so one of the things the book underscores is that African-Americans from almost the beginning of the nation through recent times have been a really progressive voice in the politics of the nation. And if we think big about the way black workers played a role, we can look back, for example, at the anti-slavery movement before the Civil War. Black workers were formative actors in that movement in all kinds of ways, in terms of the Underground Railroad and articulating ideals about emancipation and freedom and so on. But it didn't stop there. During the industrial era, after the emancipation of some 4 million black people, African Americans were a major voice in the sort of transformation of America into what became gradually a more inclusive democracy, and what I call and historians call the long civil rights movement was a major factor in making America more inclusive in terms of the franchise, in terms of rights, and in terms of creating a more multiracial rather than this sense of America as a single and white supremacist social order. And so black workers played a role in the civil rights movement. And more recently, I would say, we need to pay attention to the role of poor and working class African-Americans in this current moment in African-American history, particularly with the struggle against the carceral state, the role of the Black Lives Matter movement. And so that historically, from enslavement to industrialism to the emerging post-industrial digital age, I would underscore, and this book tries to underscore, that African-American workers are central and important to any discussion of American politics. And they're not just important for discussions of American racial politics, but they are important to the discussion of American class politics. And so that's the way I would respond to your question about the current political moment in African-American and U.S. history, and the way in which the upcoming presidential election of 2020 is going to have a great bearing on the way these issues play out, both in class, racial, and you know, other terms.
Let me ask you too. Since we're at this altitude in terms of asking these questions, because one of the stories that I think has been somewhat submerged in all of the autopsies, as it were, of that 2016 election, and of course there's a lot of different cross currents, but particularly when we look at in the context of sort of electoral cohorts. You know, we did talk a lot about that white working class voting for Trump, but what we didn't talk about really that much, which was definitely just as, if not more relevant to Donald Trump's victory, was the elements of the black working class that did not come out for Hillary Clinton, particularly in three states which have a long history of a black urban working class. And I'm thinking about like Milwaukee, and I'm thinking about Michigan, and I'm thinking about Philadelphia. Amongst those three the cities and the states that they're located in, that was the difference in the election in terms of, you know, the actual Electoral College. And so how much does knowing the history having a greater awareness of this cohort implicate politics in the current day? I mean, do we need to know that to understand the relevance and maybe the desires or those factors that would motivate those people to come out and vote?
So your question then, I want you to clarify it. Are you talking about those people who didn't vote?
Yes, who did not vote, who stayed at home.
I mean, okay. Well, you see, staying at home is always a form of voting, right? It's a form of decision-making that people make. So it doesn't mean that they are would vote. You don't know how they would have voted, right?
Right.
If they had gone to the polls. And so what we need to do, I think, is to recognize that the number of people who come out in any election, we have there's a big discrepancy between the number of citizens who are eligible to vote and the number of citizens who actually vote. And so I think that, but among African Americans, you know, you start seeing the racial variable. But what I would say is that the nature of the mobilization and grassroots efforts within communities is an important factor and variable in the number of people who actually show up at the polls. But I think that we do have to consider not just the fact that they didn't vote, but the reasons, you know, that they didn't vote.
All right. Well, let's go to the history that you tell in the book. And it starts with, addressing what I think is somewhat counterintuitive, at least for people who, you know, have not looked into this, is that there was a substantial amount of urban black labor that was constructing colonial cities, that we have this perspective of black workers and black labor being, you know, particularly before the Great Migration, a rural phenomena, but there was also a substantial amount of black workers in developing American cities.
Oh, yes. A very good question, and I'm glad you focused on that, because, in fact, the book is really geared toward understanding better the history of black workers in the urban economy and politics of the nation. From the beginning, from the colonial period, as you suggested. And one reason for that is that we do have quite a bit of research that underscores the ways in which black people working in rice production, cotton, sugar, and tobacco, among other crops, we know quite a bit about how enslaved workers on those plantations enriched Americans, both rural and urban, and the way in which they were a factor in the wealth and power of the nation. And what I'm trying to do in this book is to suggest that process that existed in the rural areas was also a process that unfolded in cities proper, and that from the beginning in these colonial cities, not just Charleston, New Orleans, and Baltimore and other southern cities, but African-American labor helped to fuel early American cities in the Northeast, New York, Boston, and Philadelphia. So there is a way in which the book tries to capture the nature of the labor that African-American contributed to these urban centers across the country during several different moments in U.S. history. And when you look at it, black people helped to build what I call the pre-industrial or colonial and early American cities before the Civil War, but they also helped to fuel the rise and expansion of these industrial cities after the Civil War, including Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh, and other cities of the industrial Midwest and Northeast. And so there is two moments, sort of a pre-industrial moment, an industrial moment, very important in terms of black workers helping to really add their energy to the engine of American urban capitalist development in the 20th century. And let me say this also. This book also tries to make sense of what all that meant. And one of the things that it meant is that it helps us to counter certain enduring stereotypes about black working class and poor people in America. For example, there remains a widespread belief that African Americans have a poor work ethic, particularly poor and working class blacks, and that they do not contribute substantially to the wealth and power of the nation. There's this image of poor and working class blacks as sort of takers rather than contributors or givers.
We heard this. This is Mitt Romney's famous, 47% are takers, and there were 53%, the 47%, and we hear it in a myriad of different ways. But yes,
yes, exactly, and that they are liabilities, right, instead of assets, and they consume rather than produce, and so there is this image, and so what this book tries to do is to recapture the labor and contributions of African-Americans at the bottom of the American economy from the beginning of the colonial era through the emerging digital age. But I also like to make the point that they contributed as enslaved workers in both cities and the countryside. But before the Civil War, they also contributed as free blacks who had managed to claw their way into freedom before the Civil War, so that by the time of the Civil War, at least 500,000 African-Americans could claim their freedom papers, so that when the Civil War actually hit, emancipation came about, at least 500,000 of them could say, the Emancipation Proclamation did not legally free me. I was free earlier. And all of these, this entire generation before the Civil War, they were not just general laborers, household servants, cooks, butlers, waiters, and so on. They were also skilled artisans. And between roughly the American Revolution and about 1820, they were substantially employed in these artisan jobs, as carpenters, blacksmiths, coopers, and so on. And so that there is a way in which the labor that we're talking about was not just simply the general, what we might call the unskilled labor, but it was labor that had come about through a process of training and apprenticeship as craftsmen. And some of these craftsmen were building up on skills that they brought from Africa, while others were actually apprenticed under European artisans under the system of enslavement. And it's a really, I think, intricate and complicated kind of history of how black people contributed to the building of the nation. But the documents are clear that they were there from the beginning.
Can you?
Thus the title. Yes.
Okay. Well, because I'm actually particularly fascinated by the ebb and flow of how the black worker had more of a hold or foothold in the skilled as artisans in the skilled not professions but jobs and labor, because that provided
the
that provided them the sort of the ability to generate to theoretically to be entrepreneurial, right? I mean to establish their own wealth and source of wealth and create their own businesses, and how there was to what extent there was a consciousness of that. So when we allowed in a lot more migrants and sort of squeezed black folk out of those crafts, let's say, and denied them and pushed them back down into sort of unskilled labor pools, as opposed to, you know, where they how. Can you talk about how black participation in those crafts expanded and contracted at different times, and to what extent was there a conscious, to what extent was increased migration, immigrant, you know, allowing immigrants in a way to sort of like replace black workers who have had who established a beachhead in those crafts?
Right, exactly. A good question, because this is one of the great moments in 19th century African-American history when millions, I think an estimated 4 million European immigrants, mainly from Germany and Ireland, they immigrated to the United States between the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, and their numbers just escalated. And they went in high and disproportionate numbers into these urban centers where African Americans were located. And they entered jobs that had become African American footholds during the period right after the American Revolution, for example. White workers began to exit the barbering trade, which was considered by them a servile kind of occupation that was not fitting for new independent white male citizens of a new republic. You know, so they felt that they had to give up that niche and move into higher callings. And so they opened a vacuum whereby black workers started to occupy some of these lower rung jobs that were considered household service type jobs, like barbering, and also as cart men, you know, just traveling and transporting goods and materials across the city, and just general labor kinds of jobs. Those jobs became important for blacks. But with the immigration of Germans and immigrants, the Germans and immigrants, by the way, they were the ones, skilled people, who displaced the black artisan, so that between the American Revolution, well, roughly between the 1810s and the Civil War, that is where the bulk of African Americans faced a downward spiral in the ability to hold on to the artisan crafts. And so, you know, I'm trying to tell two stories here about the impact of these immigrants. These immigrants were coming to America under duress as well. I mean, they were looking to improve their position in the world and to establish a footing that would give them a better living. But at the same time, they were able to take advantage of a very sharp turn in the racial system, so that black people were increasingly the victims of a kind of racism that underscored a movement to actually export at least as free blacks out of the country. And so that's another story about the American Colonization Society. But my point here is that the book talks about how blacks were not only displaced from artisan jobs as brick masons, blacksmiths, barrel makers, and so on. They were also displaced from what was considered these lower level, quote, service jobs. The barbering trade, which had opened up to blacks, had nearly closed again by the onset of the Civil War. And Frederick Douglass, he actually had a striking commentary on that process. And he said something to the effect that a few years ago, and he was talking in the 1850s, and he said something to the effect that a few years ago, a white barber would have been sort of an oddity or some kind of exceptional figure. And then he said, but recently, in the context of this immigration of Germans and Irish into the country, he said their barbering stands are everywhere, and that black barbers are beginning to lose their footing.
And how much of that do you think was by design? How much of that was heading an awareness by the U.S. government and the various different forces there that we're increasingly becoming, coming to this inflection point about slaves, and it's creating this tension, and there's a movement at that time to perhaps like send the African Americans to Liberia or whatever it is. How much of was in the mind when we had this mass immigration? How much of that was a function of an awareness of like this is a method of shaking African Americans from that foothold that they have established in these crafts?
Okay, well, I don't have the document that would say, outright that it's time to, move blacks out of all these occupations. I think it was a little bit more complicated and nuanced than that. And I say that simply because African Americans, free blacks and enslaved people, they remained a factor in the competition between white employers and elites and white workers. And so black people were part of a broader set of negotiations and conflict. And so the owners of industry, businesses, they were not, in my way of reading the record, prepared to totally dismiss the idea of using blacks strategically to empower themselves and undercut the capacity of these white workers to become too comfortable and too empowered that they would challenge the power of elites. So I think there was a complicated set of circumstances, but overall, the racial dynamic put these immigrants and American-born white elites in cooperation with each other to such an extent that white workers always could presume an advantage over black workers. But when they did push too hard, then white employers could use their prerogative to place blacks in jobs that otherwise immigrants would fill. And so I think it was more of a dynamic. It wasn't a cut and dry decision
right.
that went unilaterally forward. But I will say this. The creation of the American Colonization Society in 1816, that was a deliberate decision which said that we are going to create a white, free white republic, and we're going to add to that republic an unfree, enslaved black labor force. And so what they said in establishing their mission is that we're going to rid the country of the free black community. And in that way, we are able to remove from the body politic a kind of a constituency and the potential for an alliance between enslaved people and free people that could challenge the institution of slavery. And so there was a way in which they did try to isolate the enslaved population in such a way that they would feel powerless in the struggle to gain their own freedom, if they would move, because there was always an ongoing relationship between people who became free and people who remained enslaved.
Right.
And on the and throughout and even in these urban areas, the enslaved blacks had relatives who were free, and those relatives in turn played a role in establishing strategies that would free their own relatives and also open the door for greater emancipation for African Americans more generally.
And this is a little bit, I mean, this is, there's a there, some time ago, I have to be honest with you, I can't remember, but it was within the past couple of years, I interviewed Annalisa Cox, who wrote a book called The Bone and the Sinew of the Land, which told the story of many black, free black farmers between 1800 and 1860 that were building sort of, you know, and this is more of a rural story, but they were free men who were having success in farming in the, in what were then the Northwest Territories. And we see a concerted effort by the white population to dispossess them of these lands. Because of their success, as opposed to, because they have to swoop in because of a supposed failure. Well, I want to jump forward here because we don't have too much time left here. But one of the things that I was struck by is the picture on your on the book of workers, of African-American workers working on a train. They are women. Yeah. And this picture
That's right.
is from 1945. Which is
yes.
which coincides with an era when the Philip Randolph's union, he was the leader of the union of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and Maids,
right.
And that, will you just talk about that fight, because I'm fascinated by this dynamic where, you know, this is around the time where we see the things like Social Security implemented, which of course sidelined essentially, or purposely left out, I think the history
right.
now shows us, African American
right.
workers by not including domestic workers, not including any farm workers at that time, and particularly
right.
were sort of dispossessing, I guess, African American women,
yeah.
and this story of this union battle did the same thing.
Right.
Will you just tell that story?
Yeah, very briefly. The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters was initially the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and Maids. So it recognized that there were both male porters and there were women who worked in cleaning the rails of the cars once they reached the station, and did pretty much the household labor for the trains and the porter cars. But in the negotiation with the union, with the company, the Pullman Company, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters made a great compromise, which undercut the lives of black women. The porters, by the way, were able to sustain an organized movement and to succeed as an international labor union because they had created this tremendous auxiliary, the women. Family members and workers in the railroad industry, wives of these porters and so on, they had created a women's auxiliary, and they were the one that raised the funds and did the promotional work that helped the union, Randolph and others, sustain this organized labor movement focused on black workers in this railroad industry. But once the company negotiated with the Brotherhood, the company, of course, wanted to eliminate as many concessions to the union as they could. And one of the things that the union conceded is that the women in these sleeping cars and the household kind of workers around there, the cleaning women and so on, janitorial, custodial, that they would not be included. And in fact, they were going to drop the designation Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and Maids, and they were just going to make it the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, an all-male union that really pushed women to the side and simply underscored how limited along gender lines was the Brotherhood during that period.
Yeah, I found that fascinating because we have these sort of different moments in the history where we see sort of, you know, a dynamic where you get a sense of where, you know, where people have to climb over other people to get what little they can out of capital, essentially. We saw that, you know, with that wave of immigration that pushed black craftsmen down. And then we see it in this context. Your history takes us all the way up close to the present day when you recount where, as you know, in 1964, following the Civil Rights Act and the sort of the slow emancipation of women as well entering into the workforce with any type of meaningful power and black folk without the civil the ability for folks to discriminate against them. At that right. time, we saw a maybe coincidental, a contraction of the manufacturing base. And so it was sort of like a double squeeze on workers across the board, but the sort of, it's like, I wouldn't say quite getting to the promised land and finding that all the water has run out, as it were. But there was a quality right. of that, right? I mean, there was a bit of that is the story.
Right, exactly. It was that history has produced all these moments of movement forward and then stagnation and decline. You know, so we as historians have to just document these complicated currents of progress and and backward slides and so on. So, yes, you're absolutely right. The 1960s, 70s start to see the way the industrial order was unraveling and the way in which black workers, women workers, and all workers who were in the industrial system, white workers, were losing their footing in these established manufacturing centers, and they would have to face the music of reorienting themselves to an emerging new economy that was marked pretty much, you know, by the globalization of these processes. And they had always contained an element of transnationalism, but now you see the opening up of the economy to the disappearance of some of these industries into other countries, and the way in which workers were affected by all that.
And in fact, next week, or I should say this week, relative to when this is going to run, we have the Nevada caucuses, which are dominated by unions that are service unions, which is the sort of the next iteration of that story. But Professor Joe William Trotter, the book is Workers on Arrival, Black Labor in the Making of America. Thank you so much for your time today. Really interesting stuff.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.